You're listening to Precinct 444, a podcast network from the National Law Enforcement Museum. Today we're bringing you an episode from Law and Disorder, where we dive into the world of true crime stories with memorable cases that have lasting effects for law enforcement.
On Precinct 444, we have discussed DNA evidence fairly substantially, but mostly in the context of the O.J. Simpson trial. Some of our initial episodes of our show Encore shared one of the National Law Enforcement Museum's previous programs titled The People vs. O.J. Simpson, A Case for DNA, and then we covered the O.J. Simpson case here on Law and Disorder in the first two parts when we first released the show. The O.J. Simpson case was crucial in bringing the concept of DNA evidence into public light. In 1995, the practice of analyzing DNA to aid in criminal investigations was still very much in its infancy. The first time we used it in a court of law was in 1986. But the size of the sample needed to be substantial in order to get an accurate genetic fingerprint on a suspect or even a victim. And even then, the science behind it seemed so complicated that the general public felt almost afraid of the potential for DNA evidence. It felt intrusive. It felt like a concept that would only exist in a sci-fi novel. The perception of DNA evidence really began to change with the growing popularity of crime dramas like Law & Order and CSI. They featured outlandish scenes of investigators plugging a vial of blood into a computer and immediately getting a photo of their perpetrator to pop up on the screen. The presence of DNA evidence, while fictional, though, brought the concept into more homes, and just as the shows altered public perception of the realities of law enforcement, they also altered our perception and understanding of DNA and its use within the field of law enforcement. Advancements in DNA analysis technology were not necessarily made with law enforcement in mind, but they certainly have had a lasting impact on the way that DNA can be used in our criminal justice system. Within the last decade, we have seen an incredible interest in genetic genealogy. Companies like 23andMe and Ancestry were among the first to offer a service where one could send in a DNA sample, typically a saliva sample and a specially made vial, and they could learn about their family tree. They could find long-lost relatives and learn more about where they came from. I'm among the many who have participated in this. I sent a 23andMe kit years ago, and while I had a fairly good idea of where my family was from, it was truly fascinating to see how specific traits I have are in common with other genetic family members I've never met before, and even where some of those physical traits I have originate from geographically. But genetic genealogy, how does that work? It seems, again, kind of outlandish and very new, very sci-fi-like, but it's something that we're seeing in our everyday. It's coming home with us. It's something that is fairly commonplace. So how does that genetic genealogy work? So it starts by using autosomal DNA single nucleotide polymorphisms to discover recent common ancestors between two or more people. I know, that sounds very complicated. But when we explain it in layman's terms, it's pretty simple. Essentially, people who are genetically related will share specific markers on their genes. Through complex genetic research, geneticists and anthropologists have discovered that certain genetic markers and traits tend to originate from specific geographic areas, which can help not only to connect genetic family members together, but also tell them where they come from. The math for genetic genealogy looks something like this. Your DNA is going to be roughly 50% similar to each of your biological parents, and then 25% similar for each of your biological grandparents. And then for each generation since two people shared a common ancestor, such as grandparents, their genetic similarity is going to be reduced to about one quarter, which means first cousins who have the same grandparents are going to share about 12.5% of their DNA. Second cousins are going to share about 3.125% of their DNA, and then third cousins are going to share less than 1% of their DNA. But this technology is not only helpful for the genealogy buff. This technology has also rapidly become more and more useful for law enforcement, and it's a rather controversial subject. Many customers of 23andMe, Ancestry, and other genetic genealogy services have expressed concerns over privacy and the ethics about law enforcement using genealogical DNA in their investigations. Many customers are worried that these private companies may just allow anyone access to their genetic sample without their express consent. I'm here to tell you that it's not that simple. In my research for this episode, I have discovered that there are privacy measures in place. You do have to give express permission for your sample to be used to aid in an investigation. There's an excellent and very recent TED Talk by Claire Glynn that describes this in more detail, and we've included that link in the show notes or the description of the show if you choose to watch. I definitely recommend it. But then, what does the use of genetic genealogy look like in an investigation? Detectives aren't necessarily constructing family trees like an at-home genealogist would be. So what use can this technology have, and what does that use look like? Well, forensic genealogy has proved to be a valuable asset when it comes to solving cold cases, cases that have vexed law enforcement agencies for decades. And programs are popping up all over the country, not just in major cities. They're swiftly serving this long-awaited justice that many families and victims have been seeking for years. The first case to really put forensic genealogy on the map was that of the Golden State Killer and East Area Rapist out of California. While investigators had a very clear description of the perpetrator from witnesses, and DNA evidence had been collected from a number of scenes, they ultimately linked 13 murders and over 50 rape cases from the 1970s and 80s to the same perpetrator. But they could not find their man. When the DNA was analyzed, it never came up with an existing match, and investigators really struggled to obtain enough probable cause about specific suspects in order to obtain a warrant and collect a sample. The violent cases vexed detectives for decades, and they felt like they had gone out of their way to turn over every possible stone in the cases. But this all changed when investigators decided to employ a rather new and ultimately risky type of DNA analysis into the investigation, forensic genealogy. In the case of the Golden State Killer, investigators began creating a genetic profile. They used genetic material that had been collected from the crime scenes and then loaded them into a genotype chip. The genotype chip looks much like a computer chip. It features a number of microscopic wells that contain over 700,000 probes, and each probe matches up to a unique genetic variant, which may or may not be present in someone's unique DNA. From there, fluorescent dyes are then used to isolate the appropriate probes on the chip, making them readable on a computer, and the computer will then identify the series of DNA letters in the sample, creating a readable genetic profile. Once that genetic profile is created, the genetic sequence of the unknown perpetrator will be uploaded into a public database that hosts the catalog of genetic profiles of over 1 million users of genetic ancestry sites, like 23andMe, Ancestry, and GEDmatch, to name a few. In these databases, consumers can search to learn about variants that might reveal a genetic predisposition to disease, or where their often distant relatives live throughout the world. Law enforcement is using this technology to see whether or not their unknown perpetrator is closely related to other people in the database, as calculated from the number of shared genetic variants. Remember, we share roughly 50% of our DNA with our biological parents, 25% with biological grandparents, and about 12.5% with first cousins, as I mentioned earlier in the episode. For most cases, third cousins are probably going to be the closest relation that forensic genealogists can find within these databases, unless the perpetrator's entire family is obsessed with their genetic genealogy and got everybody a 23andMe kit for Christmas. Third cousins were the closest relation found in the Golden State Killer East Area Rapist case. From there, renowned forensic geneticist C.C. Moore describes the next step in the process as reverse genealogy. So essentially, investigators are going to use that family tree building kind of process to construct the perpetrator's family tree. So they're going to start with the closest genetic link and begin to work backwards to create that person's family tree. They look at marriage records, census data, and obituaries, just like what you would use if you were building your own family tree at home. but they'll also look and employ more modern methods of genealogy. Think Facebook stalking. Social media is crucial in expediting the process of genealogy in general, especially today, but it really lends a hand in speeding up forensic genealogy cases. This, combined with more traditional investigatory procedures, helped to narrow down the actual perpetrators. In the case of the Golden State Killer, many of the surviving sexual assault victims had been able to provide a rather thorough and corroborated description of the perpetrator, a 5'9", 165-pound white male around the time of his crimes. These complicated tactics led investigators to a man named Joseph James DeAngelo, who was finally arrested in April 2018. He pled guilty to 13 counts of murder and over 50 rape cases that had been attributed to the Golden State Killer and East Area Rapist. He successfully evaded law enforcement for over 40 years, leaving plenty of incriminating evidence in his wake, but ultimately, his genes could not keep his secret any longer. And while the closing of high-profile serial murder cases like the Golden State Killer have put genetic genealogy on the map, the practice is bringing justice to many other cases around the country, often one-off cases that have rocked communities to their cores and left families feeling isolated, grieving not only their loved ones, but the lack of answers about that loss that they experienced. One such case occurred very near to where I grew up in Fort Wayne, Indiana. On Good Friday in April of 1988, an 8-year-old girl named April Tinsley went missing. She had been playing with a friend in her neighborhood and had forgotten her umbrella at the friend's house. As she headed back to the friend's house to collect the umbrella, she was abducted. April was missing for 3 days, and while Fort Wayne is the second largest city in the state of Indiana, it feels far more like a small town. Neighbors and friends rallied around April's family, trying desperately to find clues as to where the young girl had gone. On the following Monday, April's body was found by a jogger, abandoned in a ditch about 20 miles from her home. She had been raped by her attacker, and his DNA had been left on her clothing. The community was devastated and shocked by April's murder. Investigators immediately launched into a search for the perpetrator, but couldn't find a suspect. At the time of April's murder, DNA analysis was truly infantile. The first time it had been used in an American court was only 2 years before, in 1986, and outside of learning some rather vague details about her killer, analysis of the DNA sample really wasn't enough to actually identify him. To add insult to injury, the killer began to anonymously taunt the public. 2 years after April's murder, a farmer in a neighboring county discovered a cryptic message scrawled on his barn door in what appeared to be pencil or crayon and honestly looked like a child had written it. "I kill 8-year-old April Marie Tisley, and I will kill again." The short message, riddled with misspellings, even a misspelling of the victim's name, and grammatical errors, really terrified the public. 14 years after her murder, 4 chilling notes were left at various Fort Wayne area residences. They were penned by the killer in a very similar scrawl to that note on the barn door, and placed inside plastic baggies with used condoms or Polaroid pictures of the killer's body. These messages claimed responsibility for the rape and murder of April Tinsley, and claims that he had been watching the recipients of the notes, intending to claim them as his next victims. Some of the notes were left on or near the bicycles of young girls in the area, left in front yards while they went inside after a day of play. I remember these notes being in the news. The girls that were finding these notes on their bicycles were typically between mine and my sister's ages at the time. I distinctly remember my mom, who was an elementary teacher, telling us over dinner that if we ever saw something near our bikes or any of the other various toys we were notorious for leaving in the yard, that we were not to touch it and to find an adult immediately. Luckily, we never received any of the notes. We were living a bit more north than most of the notes recipients were living, but we were on high alert for quite some time, and it was a very frightening time, especially as a small child, to know that someone was watching people my age with the intent to attack and kill us. It's very scary, and it's something that really can rack your nerves as an adult thinking about it, but especially as a child. The DNA from the used condoms that accompanied the cryptic notes matched the DNA evidence that had been collected in the case in 1988. So law enforcement was hopeful that it would bring them closer to the killer, especially if he continued to leave notes and evidence behind. However, when the DNA was uploaded to the state and national databases, investigators still came up with nothing. There was no match existing in those databases. In 2009, the FBI was consulted on the case, and they marked the case as highly solvable. But the killer didn't leave any more notes. He didn't leave any more evidence behind. No more traces. So he was silent once more. Fort Wayne police and April's family refused to give up on the case. And then, in May 2018, just 2 weeks after police in California successfully used genetic DNA testing analysis to identify and arrest the Golden State Killer, Fort Wayne Police Detective Brian Martin arranged for genetic DNA testing to be performed in April Tinsley's case. The genetic analysis was done by Parabon Nano Labs in Reston, Virginia, and Parabon was able to narrow down the possible suspects in the case to a pair of brothers from the Fort Wayne area. A search of the suspect's trash found a DNA sample, and it was a match. After 30 years, April Tinsley's killer had finally been identified. Allen County prosecutors issued an affidavit to arrest John D. Miller, a man from the Fort Wayne area, and one of the two brothers that had been identified as possible suspects by Parabon Nano Labs. The 59-year-old was arrested at his Grable, Indiana home and charged with murder, child molestation, and criminal confinement in Tinsley's death. When police brought him in for questioning, he immediately admitted to the crime. On July 17, 2018, the case of April Tinsley was finally closed. April's mother, Janet, expressed relief that her daughter's case was finally solved after years of fearing that an arrest would never be made. She even said to an HLN reporter, "I can't believe it's finally here," referring to that justice they'd long waited for. April Tinsley is not the only victim who has found justice thanks to these advancements in both genealogy and DNA analysis technologies, and she certainly will not be the last. It's a relief to know that after over three decades, her family was finally able to find some answers, and it's encouraging for other families in similar circumstances to feel that there's finally hope that the justice that they seek will also come to them. In Fort Wayne, there's a beautiful garden that's dedicated to April and her memory that many people have found solace in as we waited for those answers to come from the case. And it's really nice to know that now not only do we have that garden that's in her memory, but we actually have those answers about what happened to her, and her family has kind of that peace from seeking justice in this case. Forensic genealogy is just one of many technological advancements that are helping to close some of the most vexing cases around the country in ways that would have seemed nearly impossible in 1995 when the O.J. Simpson case introduced the general public to DNA analysis. Advancements in DNA technology remain ever-evolving, but for now, these current advancements provide a renewed sense of hope for those seeking justice where it felt like justice would never be served. Thank you for listening to this episode of Law and Disorder. We hope to see you next month when we cover yet another case, and we hope to see you very soon back at the Precinct.
Please subscribe to Precinct 444 on your favorite podcasting platform to stay connected and to receive our latest content as soon as it drops. We would love to hear from you. Send in your questions, comments, and feedback to precinct444@nleomf.org. You can help us make our content even better. The National Law Enforcement Museum is located at 444 East Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., and is dedicated to telling the story of American law enforcement. We expand and enrich the relationship between law enforcement and the community through educational journeys, immersive exhibitions, and insightful programs. Find us online at lawenforcementmuseum.org and stay tuned for more podcast content from Precinct 444. Until next time, stay safe. We'll see you at the Precinct.